Welcome everyone to this new episode of Geopolitical Report podcast. I'm Gianluca Bifolchi, your host and the research manager at Special Eurasia. And today we would like to discuss with Cesare Figari Barberis the issues related to the South Caucasus. Hi Cesare, how are you?
Hi Giuliano, I'm good. You? Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and I'm pretty fine. So Cesare is a 50-year PhD student in international relations and political science at the Graduate Institute of Geneva. His research focuses on ideology, emotions, and trauma in the South Caucasus. So he is the right person to talk about the current events and geopolitical dynamics in the South Caucasus. So my first question is related to Georgia, as you can imagine, because in the last weeks, you know, Georgia has attracted the attention of international media because of this so-called Russian law, or the law against these foreign agents. So we watch on TV the protests and riots in the country, and I would like to know more about you, from you, like about this issue, about this so-called Russian law, if it is really Russian law, we can, you know, we can say, we can ascribe what is happening now in Georgia in the field of information warfare or misunderstanding?
Okay, thank you for the question, Giuliano. So I would like to divide the issue between a topic of narratives that are taking place between the people that protest and the government and what we can say as analysts. Indeed, the people protesting, and I participated in these protests last year, so not this year, but last year for the same foreign agent law. The people call it a Russian law, so they say Ara Rusul Karuns, which means no to the Russian law, and they tend to frame the government and its the members of parliament as Russian agents or directly Russians. So they call them, for example, Rusebo, which means all Russians. So the idea here is that the population is pro-European, wants to integrate in the European Union, become a member of the European Union, while the government is becoming pro-Russian, is pro-Russian, and Ivanishvili, which is the person behind Georgian Dream, the government party, is basically a Russian agent. I would like to move beyond this narrative and Russian law. I mean, why call it Russian law? I don't necessarily see the point of calling it a Russian law. Yes, it does have similarities with a law that was adopted in Russia, which limited NGOs, but there's other countries that limit the agency of NGOs. They restrict NGOs. Staying in the Caucasus, even Azerbaijan, for example, restricted the agency and freedom of NGOs, both during the 2014 crackdown and more recently in 2021. You cannot carry out your activities freely in Azerbaijan as an NGO. You have to register with a government agency, and then basically you can be manipulated by them. Nobody called this law adopted in Azerbaijan a Russian law. So why does everything necessarily have to be reconduced to Russia? I don't necessarily see this as a Russian law. I don't necessarily think that the government is pro-Russian per se. This doesn't mean that the law is good. It does indeed limit the agency of NGOs, because those NGOs that receive more than 20% of funding from an agency, from foreign countries, would be classified as foreign agents, basically, which has a bit of a stigma to it, right? And they would have to be checked by the Ministry of Justice every 6 months. If they do not comply, they would get a big fine. So clearly, in absence of a real political opposition, because the only real political party in opposition to Georgian law, which has some votes, is the United National Movement of Saakashvili. But it's a party that really people do not favor. It may be strange, but people dislike the United National Movement more than they dislike Georgian Dream. And this is by statistics, by surveys. We can see it in one survey, the International Republican Institute survey. So the issue here is, for me, not necessarily a pro-Russian government against a pro-European people. The problem here is a government and Ivanishvili, the leader, the de facto leader of this government, which is trying to make the country more autocratic. So he's trying to become basically almost the sole ruler. Georgia is basically on the verge of going from a semi-democracy to somewhat more of an autocracy, in which Ivanishvili It's not the president, it's not the prime minister, but it's the person behind all of this. And this is a big risk because, as we said, there's no real strong political opposition. So a lot of the opposition is done by NGOs. If you restrict the agency and the freedom of NGOs, then you're de facto restricting even more the political sphere of the country. Ivanish really, therefore, wants to become more powerful. He wants to concentrate power in his hands. And it's no coincidence, this is the last thing I will add, that at the same time, the government not only wants to pass this so-called Russian law or law against NGOs, but they also want to pass a new law which would allow Georgians to bring money from foreign countries, for example, from Cayman Islands and so on, into Georgia with paying little to no taxes and having little to no accountability bringing back this money. Clearly, this is a way of Ivanishvili trying to bring back money from abroad into Georgia and increasing his power. One just needs to look at Ivanishvili's discourse that he made in late April, accusing NGOs, Europe, some LGBTQ people. He kind of also tied LGBTQ people with these NGOs, foreign-funded NGOs, to see how it's a little bit... Ivanishvili is a bit in a conspiracy theory mindset now, and I would concentrate much more on his figure than on Russia.
Thanks, Cesarev. You provide us an interesting, point of view, also interesting insight regarding the Georgian domestic politics, also the issues related to this law. And so moving from Georgia to neighboring countries, we can talk about, Armenia and Azerbaijan. Recently, you wrote a paper in Italian language, an interesting paper regarding the Nagorno-Karabakh region, which is called from the local Armenians as Artsakh, like from the Azerbaijani authorities, it just called it as Karabakh. So probably I said all the three the first terms that usually people can use. And you wrote this paper regarding the future of the Armenians of the Nagorno-Karabakh. And according to your opinion, also your studies and research, so do you believe that at one point in the future they can go back to their homeland? Or if we look at Baku's domestic policies and strategies, probably this region will lose completely the Armenian population and the vacuum of people will be filled by Azeri people?
So thanks for the question. As indeed I wrote in this article for ISPI, I'm unfortunately very pessimistic on this account, because essentially nobody is pushing for a right of return of these Armenians. Let's start with Azerbaijan itself. So Azerbaijan did absolutely almost nothing to convince Armenians either to stay or to come back. It did some symbolic gestures. So it opened an online portal to ask to be integrated. But if you go on this online portal, and I put the link actually in the article for ISPI, there's nothing there. They don't explain anything. And overall, the government never fully said how this integration plan would unfold. At the same time, we see that the government of Azerbaijan has been destroying part of the Armenian cultural historical heritage in Karabakh, both Nagorno-Karabakh and Karabakh. Recently, for example, one of Shushi's churches, an early 19th century church in Shusha, has been completely razed to the ground. Some cemeteries have also been completely razed to the ground. Aliyev has visited some churches, in Armenian churches in Hadrut, and said, for example, that these are not really Armenian, they are actually Caucasian Albanian, which according to the Azerbaijani narrative are the true, real, original and indigenous inhabitants of Karabakh. And Armenians only came later in the 19th century and faked. So they falsified the history and basically appropriated this Caucasian Albanian heritage. So everything that is Armenian is actually not Armenian, according to Azerbaijani narrative. And this is also what they study, for example, in school, in history textbook. So all of this narrative and propaganda is what is official, is institutionalized, and is what Azerbaijani kids grow up with and they end up believing. So on the Azerbaijani side, there is absolutely no effort whatsoever to reintegrate these Armenians. They actually keep the hate speech and aggressive rhetoric. On the international actors side, neither the European Union nor the US are pressuring Azerbaijan to allow a reintegration of Armenians. So recently, for example, there was a meeting, an event between Blinken, von der Leyen and Pashinyan. And good for Armenia, they proposed a package of financial help to Armenia, also to help reintegrate the Armenian refugees. But by reintegrate Armenian refugees, they mean reintegrate in Armenia itself. So they gave money to help support Armenian institutions to support these refugees, but only to reintegrate in Armenia, not to go back to Azerbaijan. So there's absolutely no pressure from outside major forces like the European Union or the United States. And finally, also Pashinyan has kind of is also pessimistic. He openly said in an interview that he is pessimistic about this, about Armenian refugees from Karabakh going back to Karabakh. Maybe they will be signed, Armenia and Azerbaijan will sign a peace treaty, hopefully this year, we don't know. I'm a bit pessimistic about that. But even if they do sign it, there is no sign that Pashinyan is pressuring Aliyev to include something on possible cultural autonomy, not even political autonomy, but cultural autonomy for Armenians in Karabakh. Pashinyan seems much more focused on what he calls the real Armenia, not the historical Armenia. So he's much more focused on the Armenian state, not on Karabakh Armenians. He wants to protect the Armenian state, its borders, but he seems to have taken off the agenda anything which has to do with the reintegration of Karabakh Armenians in Karabakh proper. So unfortunately, I'm very, very pessimistic about potential coming back of Armenians to Karabakh, and this is essentially for the foreseeable future, the end of this not only century-long, but millennia-long Armenian presence in Karabakh.
Thanks, Cesare. So we discussed with you the contemporary situation, the current situation in Georgia, also this confrontation between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and we should also remind to our followers and to our listeners that Azerbaijan retake control of the territory of Nagorno-Karabakh thanks to the military power, thanks to conflicts, or at least the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and the September 2023 conflict of military operation. So what we are witnessing regarding the South Caucasus is that it seems that the region doesn't have the standards, the European Union standards regarding democracy, regarding human rights. So my last question for you is that, despite all this situation, do you still believe that Azerbaijan, Georgia, also Armenia, they can become the future, member of the European Union or active part of the EU-Eastern Partnership? Or we are just talking about a geopolitical game and, European Union try just to exploit the situation also to face, to contrast the Russian presence and also the Turkey foreign policies in the region?
So here we have to look at two things. First, if the Caucasian countries themselves want to become members of the European Union, and if the European Union wants them to actually become members. So for Azerbaijan, it's not a problem because Azerbaijan itself doesn't want to become member of the European Union, and it said so openly. So Azerbaijan is not an issue. It won't become part of the European Union because it doesn't want to become part of the European Union. For Georgia, it's a bit tricky because the vast majority of the population wants to become part of the European Union, and the European Union recently did give candidate status to Georgia. But this NGO law is very tricky because it could indeed jeopardize the path towards the European Union of Georgia, because clearly it's a setback. Like, you go from a semi-democratic country to potentially a more autocratic country. So of course this would jeopardize its European path. However, I would have been a little bit skeptical anyway, even if this law had not been adopted and even if the Georgian government had been more democratic, more liberal, I would have been anyway skeptical of Georgia joining the European Union, because I don't see any desire by European countries to actually have Georgia in the European Union. I'm a little bit pessimistic here. Let's remind ourselves that Albania, Bosnia, Montenegro are still not part of the European Union now. And these are countries that are geographically within Europe. They're in the Balkans, and these countries are not yet part of the European Union. So imagine faraway Georgia, more faraway Georgia, with no geographic continuity, no geographic borders with other European Union countries, being part of the European Union. And it still has territorial issues over South Ossetia and Abkhazia. So I don't see the European Union actually wanting Georgia to become a member. What is tricky here is indeed understanding what is just a narrative. So the Georgians for sure want to become part of the European Union, no doubts about that. But on the European side, where is the narrative? So where is it just are they just selling a dream which they don't actually intend to implement? Or are they really serious potentially of having Georgia in the European Union? I'm a little bit pessimistic here. I don't think that Georgia has any chance. Without Turkey in the European Union, I think their chances are almost zero. But why Turkey? Because with Turkey, you would have had a geographic contiguity. So Turkey in the European Union, at that point, you can also have Georgia and Armenia because you have a geographical contiguity. Without Turkey, I don't see Georgia joining the European Union. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm a bit pessimistic. And anyway, this NGO law, I wouldn't say will destroy the potential of joining the European Union, but it will destroy the dream, at least the dream of joining the European Union. As regards to Armenia, now Pashinyan is a bit more open to the idea, but we have, again, the exact identical problems. How can you have Armenia, which has no border with any other European country except Georgia, if it did join the European Union? It's small, it's a small country, it's poor. Like, I don't see any incentive for European countries to have the Caucasus countries join. The European Union is already quite difficult to handle and to maneuver as it is. So why make the situation more complicated? They don't even have, as we said, Albania, Montenegro, and Bosnia in the European Union. The Caucasus would come only later. So I'm overall a bit pessimistic simply because I don't see the incentive, I don't see the desire on the side of the European Union. For sure, in Georgia, partially in Armenia, there is a desire, but I don't see this desire on the European side.
Thanks. Thanks, Cesare, to share with us your ideas. I can agree with you when you say that it will be really hard to see at least Georgia or Armenia part of the European Union or closer to the European Union for several reasons that you explained. So thanks again, Cesare, to be with us, to be our guest, and to describe the situation in the South Caucasus. And thanks to our listener, our follower, and I will remind you to follow us, to follow Special Eurasia, to stay in touch with us. And see you next time to Geopolitical Report podcast. Bye-bye.
Thank you for inviting me, Giuliano. Bye-bye.